Hey everyone, welcome to This Anthropological Life. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Ryan Collins. Just to remind you, This Anthropological Life is brought to you in part through collaboration with the American Anthropological Association, with the Society for Applied Anthropology, and through Sapiens.
Yeah, some of our you know, three favorite partners, again, other institutions working to do really cool public anthropology work, and so it's fun to hang out and think with them and sort of be building this bigger anthropological network. Just as another reminder, too, we are running a PayPal campaign right now, and so the idea is, like, if you wish to donate and help independent podcasting, especially This Anthro Life, you know, we have a button in a part on the right sidebar of our website that you can donate securely. It's totally safe. Through PayPal, it's all good. But you know, we are right now raising money so we can buy a little extra equipment, because we have a nearly complete mobile studio, but we want to get four mics, and that way we can easily have three hosts or two guests and two hosts at the same time. And so we're almost there. But you know, again, even $5 helps us out and makes a huge difference to us. You know, we pay for all this ourselves, websites and equipment. So anything, if you got anything coming up, it would help us immensely.
Exactly, as we continue to make this process a little bit more sophisticated, to always bring TAL to whoever we're, however we're with, whoever we're interviewing, whoever our guest might be, it's going to help out a lot, and they'll also help us develop original content that we can give back to you who donate to us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and again, this is really about a conversation with you all, right? And one thing that, you know, as you know, we said in our free think a couple weeks ago, then I actually said the last time I did introduce my other presentation that, you know, it's incredible to see that, you know, we went from 10,000 to over 12,000 and it's growing. And so it's really incredible to see the tribe, the family growing. And, you know, speaking of families, we want to talk a little bit more about the human family seems to be growing today as well. You want to tell us a little bit about what we'll be hearing today?
So today we're going to talk about one of our most enigmatic and yet recent members to the Homo family, and that's Homo naledi. Homo naledi was initially discovered about 2009 or so, but the initial reports didn't come out till about 2015. And since then, this species, this member of our family, has been subject to a little bit of controversy as well as wonder, because we haven't known when it dates to. We don't know how it fits in, and it definitely does impact our story.
Yeah, so sit back, relax, and enjoy a head-spinning journey into the world of Homo naledi.
So a week ago, Adam and I were thinking about doing an episode on human origin, fossil remains, new genetic understandings of how we actually explore the fossil record and understand our own human development. It's changing all the time. And speaking just to how rapidly things are changing, in this episode we were preparing to talk about Homo naledi and what that actually meant for sort of understanding our own origins within the genus Homo. As of today, two new articles came out, which really had to change the way we were planning this episode in the first place. Mm-hmm. So Homo naledi, just to give a little bit of background, was something that was widely published upon in 2015. It was discovered a little bit earlier, but the first real publications came out in 2015.
Yeah.
So with that, it was really interesting because you have 15 hominins. That's 15 human-like creatures found in a single cave deposit. And this cave deposit made it look like it could be ritual. It made it look like you might be seeing some sort of precursor to religion, precursor to some sort of caring and understanding of an afterlife. Mm-hmm. But the problem was, we didn't know when to date this animal. Is it closer in relationship to the Homo, to the species and genus of Homo sapiens sapiens that we are today, or was it much more further removed? Some early estimates put this around 1.9 million years ago, 2 million years ago, maybe. But recently, as again today, the new estimates suggest only 200 to 300,000 years ago, not millions, thousands.
Much closer in time, right?
Exactly.
And so I think what's so interesting about this story, besides, I mean, anytime we sort of find ourselves exploding the family tree, as it were, right? Or I remember reading even in an introductory anthropology textbook that this author argued that it's not so much a tree, it's more of a bush, right? And it goes in many directions versus just sort of, you know, the roots, the trunk, and then the branches. But so Homo naledi is so interesting because, right, like, it's one thing you're pointing out, Ryan, that we're not totally sure how old it is, right? And they originally said maybe 1.9, but then there's this huge switch of actually might be about 200 250, at most 300,000 years old, right?
Uh-huh.
Why is that weird?
So that's weird because we actually have two different types of gaps that are open in our study of human origins right now. And now if you look at that 2 million year ago date, it's really evocative because it gets us right at that moment when we're seeing the sort of last of the Australopithecines. Now, again, to use a little bit of jargon here, the Australopithecines, they're basically what we consider the precursor to the genus Homo. So this lumps together tons of different species that are probably our ancestors directly, and some that are offshoot cousins.
Yeah.
So this is really getting to the origins of our own genus, Homo, if you look at the 2 million year ago date. But if we're looking at that 200,000 year ago date, we're looking at the origins of modern Homo sapiens. Mm-hmm. That's us, right? So only 200,000 years ago, if we're putting Homo naledi, that suggests something very different about this creature, that it's not an ancestor, that it's a cousin, and that we may have actually known each other.
Yeah, it's one of those cool things, you know, because there's always been, for a long time, a ton of evidence that Homo sapiens and Homo Neanderthals interacted. Neanderthals lived primarily in Europe or Western Europe. But so Naledi is found in South Africa. And so this is particularly interesting because generally it's you know, Africa itself, which is a mega continent, right, is known as the cradle of civilization or cradle of humanity, we'll say. Not cradle of civilization, but of humanity. And that primarily came from East Africa, which you could say is the Lake Turkana region near Ethiopia and Kenya. Then also the other chunk of it was in South Africa. And so this is interesting because a lot of the, you know, famous Australopithecus efferensis, which is Lucy, which is, you know, the 2 million year old efferensis, which this is the, or sorry, 3 million year old, right? This is the older of the two potential beings that Homo sapiens sort of evolved out of. We're not quite sure. This is where this gap is, right? Is in sort of this Eastern Africa region. Then you come south and we have Naledi. Mm-hmm. And so this is very interesting timing too, because obviously what this means is, sure, Homo sapiens at some point moved up and out of Africa, as we know, and they interacted with Homo Neanderthals and Homo Florensis we can talk about. But also at the same time, this helps us think that there may be other modern, quote unquote, or modern-ish hominins like us, Homo sapiens, also at the same time in Africa itself.
Exactly. We have not actually seen this before. We've seen cousins. We've seen other types of branches around the globe that have caused us to think, well, all right, Homo sapiens were definitely living in the same space as Neanderthals, as Denisovans, which we're seeing in Siberia, as Red Deer Cave people, which we're seeing in China. Those still have pending genus and species names. But Red Deer Cave people and Denisovans kind of sound fun.
They do.
But then we also have Homo floresiensis, also known as the Hobbit in Indonesia. And the initial datings on that were about 15,000 years ago or so, but now we suspect about 50,000 years ago. But needless to say, this suggests that there's at least 4, maybe 5, maybe 6 different species of hominins running around occupying the world at the same time. Now, this is different than any type of understanding of human difference or diversity that we see today. We're talking about creatures that could have potentially interbred, but maybe not had viable offspring. We're really unclear on what that would even mean and what that would look like genetically.
Right. And so to kind of conceptualize this, because I had to look this up too to figure this out, because I don't do too much physical anthropology in my own thinking, but so we're talking about a genus and a species, right, on these two levels, right? And generally a species is when beings of the same species can interbreed, right?
Yes.
They don't always have to have viable offspring. And a good example of this is when a horse and a donkey are of the same species, they can breed, but they usually make a mule, which is then sterile and it cannot then breed.
Right.
Right.
Mules can't make other mules.
No more
mules.
Yeah, mules are at the end of the line, right?
We can think about other more fun examples that are a little bit more known today, like ligers, right? The offspring of a tiger and a lion. And they're not always viable afterwards, and they usually have a lot of health problems. But there are also tyons, tigers and lions.
Tyons.
And then you have zorses.
Horses
and zebras. There are lots of fun mules out there.
Yeah, there you go, yeah. Zorses and tyons. It sounds like we're like looking at Star Wars here. Right. So these are the same species, right? So that means that these different kinds of horse-like creatures can interbreed. So in this case, when we say Homo sapiens, the species is the Homo part. And so this would be Homo neanderthalensis. This would be Homo sapiens. This could be Homo naledi. So theoretically, all of these, if they're of the same species, could then interbreed. When you get to genus, this is just slightly more specific on the you know, taxonomic code. And so, you know, we are Homo sapiens. There's Homo erectus, which we believe sort of came before us. And this is sort of 2 million years ago. And then there's Homo naledi, which also seemed to emerge at a similar time to Homo sapiens themselves, which again, this is 200, 250,000 years ago. So this is why this is so interesting, right? Did we share a common ancestor? Maybe, probably. But also, as you're pointing out, Ryan, I think one of the most fascinating questions about this is the evolutionary tree is not so much of a tree, right? It is sort of just cousining out, spreading out.
It really is. And I mean, to just make a correction to that statement, we absolutely shared a common ancestor. Mm. But the real question is, when do we share that common ancestor?
Ah, yes.
So is it earlier? Is it more recent? Or is it much further back in time? And that actually makes a big difference.
Yeah, yeah.
So another thing, a good question that might come up in this whole issue of genus and species that we should try to conceptualize here is just the vast variation that there often is exhibited within a species like Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens, we end up having people of all shapes and sizes and skin colors, and we just look different all across the globe. Mm. When we take another creature that's also like us, that has a lot of mixed traits, we can look at dogs. We can look at a Yorkie and a Great Dane. And those two animals, believe it or not, can create viable offspring. They are still part of the same species.
Would this be like a Danish Yorkie? Or a Dorkie?
A Dorkie. We need to look into this. Yes. Like, theoretically, they could interbreed viably.
Yes. That's the question there. Yeah, exactly. So we're looking at sort of, and this is the question of when, right? And so this is, you know, whenever we're looking at paleoanthropology, right, or old anthropology, this is always one of the questions of how do we age? How do we date? Mm-hmm. Not on Tinder, but how do we date and find out how old, which you should also do if you're on Tinder, how old the person you're trying to, quote, date is.
Right. And now, I guess before we dive into dating, which we definitely need to do, we should understand a little bit about the fossil record for these early hominins and how that really helps us understand what dating techniques are viable. So when we can look at some of our earliest Australopithecine ancestors, we're talking 3 million to 4 million years ago, we really don't have many. And most of these fossils come from the Great Rift Valley in Africa. Mm. And this is basically a part of the earth that has opened up in a great valley where you can actually see the sediment from 3 million years ago on the surface today.
Wow.
Right? So we can date this because of the sedimentary layers to which we find them. And we know this because of volcanic ash. We know this because of geological time. Mm. As we get more recent, we can use a little bit more dating techniques. But where we start finding these creatures ends up getting a little more complicated. Say if we find them in caves, or if we find them in bogs, or if we find them just in other random places.
Mm. Yeah, and so that's a great point to think with in terms of what is our environmental evidence that we can use to understand what we can see, right? And a lot of these different skeletons that paleoanthropologists and hikers and people just traveling have found have been fused into rock, you know. So some of these findings are incredibly labor intensive to get a skeleton out of rock without destroying it, right? And that's an incredibly complex and difficult process, right? So part of this too, in terms of even how we do aging at all, is incredibly tricky. But I think you make a good point too, that part of our ability to age things is because we have geological formations that are easy to date around the skeletons themselves.
Yes. So this also raises two other critical points about the study of human origins that we really need to think about. And that's, what evidence do we have available and what evidence is accessible? Mm. Because the process of fossilization for bones is really rare. It's something that actually has to work out through the right conditions. So when we find a skeleton like Lucy that was averaged to be about 40% complete, that is a really complete specimen. It's really unlikely that you're going to find bones that have turned to stone in such a heavy capacity. Because you have to think, in terms of when an animal dies, there are scavengers, there are other things that will eat that animal. If we look at burial practices today, you can expect that bones will often deteriorate within 1,000 years or more. So the conditions have to be just right.
Hmm. Which is pretty awesome that, you know, so much of Africa in this regard kept these bones. It was the right conditions, right? You know,
exactly.
We're talking about usually fairly dry desert conditions that were good for in terms of, because like usually one of the biggest challenges of preservation is when the climate changes. And I don't mean ice age to non-ice age, but if it is a wet in a dry season a lot, that can be really destructive to anything, to stones too, but bones in organic matter, absolutely. When it stays relatively dry or relatively wet, this is why we'll see, like, you know, in peat bogs too, which sounds incredible. You can find beings, you know, or even organic material preserved because it stays wet the entire time, right? Since decomposition.
For sure. So with this, and you raise a really good point with the peat bogs, we get different types of preservation in different types of areas. So when we look at the Great Rift Valley, we have a very dry, arid climate, and that allows for us to see bones very well preserved. But then if you go to a place like a bog, you're not just getting the bones, but you're getting skin, you're getting cells. Mm. In fact, you're getting a chance to look at something genetically.
Right.
And most of our human origins and our understanding of that comes from a comparative assessment of bones and not genetics. So it leaves a lot to be wanted with this.
Yeah, and so part of it, we're looking really at physical remained evidence, but also by, you know, visible comparisons, right? Because obviously, if you're looking at two different bodies preserved in the peat bog and you have different skin, you actually may see facial features, right, that you wouldn't see with just skeletons. Just as a fun aside, that makes me think of, you know, when I actually did my first archaeological field school back in 2005, I was working in the north of Peru in the Lambayeque Valley, and well, not it wasn't a valley, just the region. And what was really cool about this, we were working on a site called San Jose de Moro, and it was a site that was dated back about 800 years. And so it was it was a pure desert environment, super dry. And so there was a huge cache of skeletal remains. Now, one of the people I got assigned to the coolest part of the dig site, which is the chicheria or the beer factory, which is super cool. So we were digging up these giant, ceramic vessels that they would use with big wooden paddles to stir the chicha beer. But we got to a certain point below the ceramics that we found three bodies, and one of which was done in a flexed position. Which is, you ever do like a cannonball going into a pool, right? It'd be like that. And we found two that were laid out prostrate on their back. So this interesting mix of two different ways of doing burials. What really was trippy was that the guy that we sexed to a male that was in sort of this cannonball position still had hair on his head. And it had a burlap sash on. And was incredible because he's 800 years old.
Wow.
But it was so dry and so little rainfall, and it was far enough down that even if it did rain, the rain wouldn't penetrate. Dude still had hair in his head. It was crazy.
That's fantastic. You see some of the Peruvian mummies, just as an offshoot right now, you see some Peruvian mummies where even braids are still preserved in their hair, even the skin as well. So this is a really cool area to work. Check it out as a good recommendation.
Yeah, go to Peru.
No, but back to these questions of origins, right? And what this might mean in terms of like Homo naledi and the recent rearranging of dates. Now, there's a couple problems here we should bring out.
Yeah.
As we've been talking about different types of dating techniques and how dating may come into being, the dating methods have not actually been released yet for Homo naledi. So we're kind of taking this with a leap of faith.
Yeah.
Hopefully that won't change too much, but I'm sure that there's going to be dates in the paleoanthropological community on this.
And how they did them. I mean, so generally what we know, there are three ways that paleoanthropologists can date skeletons. One is that you ask them out. So the first one is called isotopic analysis. And what that is you take small fragments of the bone itself and you actually have to, you end up destroying them because it superheats them. So it's not ideal because it destroys the sample that you also age. The other ways are nicer. One is that then you can also, as you were talking about before in terms of gorges, is that you can age the rock around it. And that will give you a pretty good level in terms of the strata, like how low it is in the geologic strata itself. Can give you a relative good time frame.
Absolutely. When we look at, for example, with this type of idea, you look at the Laetoli footprints that come out of Africa. And Laetoli is a site where we see footprints from Australopithecus afarensis dating some 3.4 million years ago or so. Now, in these footprints, we find it because a volcano erupted and these creatures were walking through the ash. Yeah. And it fits the time range for Australopithecus afarensis. So we see two individuals walking. There may have been a third, but you also see footprints of all of these other species, just tons of other animals that are also probably fleeing from this volcano.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean that's the third way that you date things too. Actually, that's why the Laetoli footprints are so important.
Yes,
because their A can tell you strata-wise maybe how old they were, but then the third evidence that we use is what other fossil remains are around in an area. This is why Naledi is also so interesting, because in the caves that they found these, again, this is in South Africa, and they're called Rising Star Caves, and so they're actually really popular for spelunkers. And so the story itself, we'll put the link up from a National Geographic story, it was actually really incredible how these two cave spelunkers even found. It's totally by accident. It usually is by accident, right? But it's these two really skinny guys that were like trying to find somewhere that they'd never, you know, had never been explored in the caves, and they were literally squeezing through. There's this area called Superman's Pass. They said you have to, and it's so skinny to get through that you have to literally have one hand above your head as if you're Superman, and the other one pressed against your side. So you look like Superman going through it, but you have to be incredibly skinny to do it.
Your shoulders won't fit through normally. You actually have to contort your shoulders so that you can get one through and wiggle your way. And you're on a ledge.
Yeah. No,
so you
thank
have to
you.
Imagine your chest or your back being suspended on this ledge that you'll either fall into or fall over on. So it's
not good.
It's precarious.
It's precarious, you know. So, but these two guys decided that was cool. Then they apparently, you know, found this other, you know, jagged wall called Dragon's Back, which also doesn't sound friendly. And proceeded to climb that. And then they were trying to film this new little area that they found. And then one of the people, like, he wanted to get out of the camera frame that his friend was filming. And so he ended up stepping down into this rock and then stepped down one more. And then he stepped down a third time and there's nothing below his foot the third time. And he decides to look down and then they find this chamber, which is incredible. Because when they discovered this, they realized, you know, after sort of paleoanthropologists came and started looking around, they found 15 individuals. Which is a huge amount. Like, I mean, again, when we talk about Lucy and you know, Australopithecus afarensis, we had 40% of her skeleton. Here we're talking about 15 individuals. And so none of them were necessarily 100% complete, but still, to have 15 is such a lucky find, right?
Right. Now, to get back to this cave, Adam already discussed how complex, how difficult it would be to get anyone into this cave. Most of our cave findings for early hominin ancestors actually come as a result of scavengers, where maybe a cheetah leaped at you from a tree, bit your friend in the skull, and then dragged them into a cave. Not a good way to go.
Bad day.
But it's good for preservation. So this is definitely not happening with this find. With the 15 Naledi skeletons, these individuals must have either gotten in there themselves or they were placed there.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so what's so interesting with this too is then why we are then calling them Homo, right? And that's because this is one of the questions. Like, so what puts them part of our species again? In this case, right, so Australopithecus is a different species and Homo is our species, right? And so one of these questions is what features do they share? And why they're so interesting is because Homo Naledi has features the same that we do as Homo sapiens, but they also have other, what we'd say, I'm putting in air quotes, primitive, which is actually much more commonly used for physical anthropology that we, you know, got adopted into cultural anthropology in the early 1900s that we've then gotten rid of. By saying people are socially more primitive, which is not something that we like to use. But anyway, so in this case, physically more primitive. And so when they would say they have features that both seem more, quote, modern, like Homo sapiens, and also more, quote, primitive, like you actually would see in chimpanzees, but also, again, you might see in you know, Homo habilis or afarensis or different older skeletal structures. And so some of the things that we saw was that, so they had legs and feet that you could tell they were designed for long distance walking. That's, we have, you know, Homo sapiens, we have longer legs, right?
Right.
You can tell our feet are designed to walk upright.
Exactly. And for comparison, if you look at your toe, your big toe, it's pretty compact with your other toes. If you look at your thumb, your thumb's pretty far removed from your other fingers.
Yes.
So once your big foot, or when your big foot, your big toe starts to look more like a human foot, you can say that that's a more modern trait. But if your foot starts to look more like your hand, that's a more primitive trait.
Yeah, that's well said. And you can actually look into, and the thumb is a good one to look at as well. For example, gorillas, you know, one of our great ape cousins. Again, they're not Homo gorillas, they're Pan, right? And so
they're actually gorilla.
Look, that's a gorilla. They're a different one. You're right altogether. Are all the five great apes, are they different? Because there's Pan, chimpanzee, and then bonobo.
Pan encompasses bonobo and chimpanzee.
Okay.
Orangutan is its own.
And then gorilla is its own, and then us.
Exactly.
Okay, so crazy. So we have three species within the five great apes. Anyway, so with that, gorilla is one of our cousins, though, but their thumbs are much further down in their hand. And so it's really interesting, just again, a random side note, also I think depicted in Michael Crichton's novel Congo, is that when they would teach gorillas sign language. You've probably heard the story of Coco and her kitten, you know. Mm. And it was really interesting just to think in terms of, you know, raise ideas of intelligence, because we'll talk about skull size in a second. That gorillas could learn sign language, that humans could teach them, but they had to adapt the signs themselves because their thumb was too low to make the same signs humans do. Mm. And so it's this really kind of cool idea. But what was really interesting is they didn't teach the gorilla how to adapt the sign. The gorilla did that by themselves. And so there is always this question, too, of intelligence in terms of our cousins. And so when we also think of Homo naledi in this case, one of the more primitive features that we see in terms of, you know, skeletal differences, the skull size is really quite small, closer to chimpanzee than it is to Homo sapien. And so it is this interesting mix of, we'll see legs and feet that are designed for long-term or long-distance walking. We also then see they have much more curved fingers, which is indicative more of climbing.
Right. And we also have to think that our ancestors, our direct ancestors, were climbers. Mm. These were apes that were swinging from tree to tree and climbing a lot, more than they would be walking. Mm. So when we look at something like chimpanzees, we see that their fingers are much longer in relationship to our hands, and they can spend more time easily up in trees. It would be a little bit harder for us to do the same type of locomotion.
Yeah, that's fair. And I mean, it's funny too, because, like, you know, again, Homo sapiens, we like to think of ourselves as humans, right? And we might say that we are because we invented the term. And then we might say that chimpanzees or bonobos are or are not, depending on how you want to define this, right? But we can brachiate just like them. And brachiate means, you know, locomote using your arms. And that's why we have the, quote, monkey bars, which really should be the great ape bars. But, you know, they could be monkey bars, too, if you wanted. We just don't have tails. Monkeys have tails and apes don't. But anyway, so it's again, like, the human tree is a fascinating thing, right? So Homo naledi is complicating this tree of what it means, A, to be in the species Homo. And then on top of that, you know, what features get passed on, and whether it's more curved fingers or more flat feet, or, you know, and again, dentition is another way you can look at this, and teeth and jaw size is something that you see difference between us great apes as well as Homo erectus and then Homo naledi. And you know, which of these features do we see coming through? And so naledi is really this interesting mix of what we might say is more primitive fingers, but more modern legs. And they'd have more modern front teeth and jaw size, but then more primitive back teeth and molars. And so there's really they're really just quite an interesting mix that, as Ryan said in the beginning, that really makes us question, how do we know where we came from?
Right. Now, this gets us into some really complex but really cool ideas about evolution and how we're constantly turning our heads around what evolution actually is and how it works. Mm. Because we're all still evolving. Evolution is simply change.
Yeah.
It is. And speciation, which is the process of creating a new species, can happen in two ways. It can happen by one species splits off from another, and that those two species now exist. And this can happen a few different times. So you have several different cousins occupying the same place. But it can also happen over time. Mm. So that we call that a chronospecies, basically just time species.
Sweet name.
Yeah, I like chrono species, like video games called Chrono Trigger.
It's just like that, yeah. That's what I was thinking of, too.
So with a chrono species, we really have to try and guess at what point of time has there been enough time between two different groups that look similar that they wouldn't have been viable if you could somehow have a time machine and put them in the same room.
Yeah.
That's a really tough question when we don't have the genetic evidence to really know.
Right. And that is actually one of the hardest things, too. And so this is why when we see other species like Homo floresiensis, we talked about, this was a species that emerged as their own different, we'd say, species from Indonesia, right? And they, I think, went extinct around 50,000 years ago.
Around 50,000.
And we know this because that was the same time that Homo sapiens, us, showed up. And so there's always this interesting question of, you know, is, you know, in a really unthought out Darwinian sense of survival of the fittest, right? Which I don't think this is the case of. It's just sort of whenever Homo sapiens tend to show up, same with Homo neanderthalensis too in Europe, which is more about 30,000 years ago, we do tend to see the other species kind of disappear. Now, we don't know at this point if Homo naledi interacted with Homo sapiens.
Right.
Likely, but we don't know that in the same way that we have evidence in, for example, Northern Europe, right? That we know that Homo neanderthalensis and sapiens interacted.
And we see that within our own genetic makeup today, with most Northern Europeans carrying between 2-4% of Neanderthal genomes within their own genome.
Yeah, which is pretty cool.
Oh, very cool.
You know, But what's so interesting too, again about this, so Homo floresiensis, right? So this group that was in Indonesia, again, they went extinct about 50,000 years ago, but they're also colloquially known as the Hobbit people.
Yes.
Right. They're very short, and they're a little more hairy. And so what's interesting too is, again, that still counts as Homo, in this case, people, right? And this is also one of the questions that we can kind of think about to sort of close our thoughts out is, again, not what counts as a person, but, you know, it's as the human family tree expands, right? And we see, we find Naledi now. And it's likely we might find other offshoots too, right? As you're saying, evolution is not a straightforward process.
Right. And evolution, because we know it's not linear now. And this is actually a really big deal, because we used to envision that things like a missing link, that sort of ancestral creature that would bridge whatever chimpanzee ancestor that we had with them and what became us, would just simply look like a mix.
Mm.
But we know that that's not necessarily the case now. And we also know that we're not the end goal of this process, that there are other things that could have branched out after us even and grown in their own different way. Speciation doesn't just occur in one direction. And yeah, that's something really cool we have to think about, especially with Homo naledi.
Yeah, that is really cool to think about. Man, all right, so my head is now spinning because I learned a lot from this episode. This has been cool. So anyway, thanks so much for joining us and listening today. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And this is Ryan Collins.
Thanks for joining us on TAL. We'll see you next time.